what a good job, and how great it is that we have young men in our congregation that are growing up and learning to love God and to share and to participate. I love that a lot. I love that about our church family. Last week, we were in our series, Meeting God's People. We saw an amazing preview of God's love as we looked at David and Mephibosheth and the way that David took him into his home. And we saw that and the grace that David showed to him. In this particular narrative, the king showed us some amazing things. He showed us mercy and love, and not because it was desired or expected, but in spite of the fact that nobody would have expected it. That's what grace looks like. Just as Mephibosheth had no reason to expect the mercy, just as Mephibosheth had no reason to expect grace, just as Mephibosheth had no reason to expect to be added into the king's family and fed at the king's table and treated like one of the king's children, so too we have no reason to expect that God would add us into his family, graft us into his olive vine, and make us a part of his family. And yet he did. That's what grace is. That's the amazing thing about the grace of God. That's what it looks like. And that's what we needed so much that we didn't even imagine that. Imagine a king for a minute. We're talking about 3,000 years ago. Imagine a king who would invite a rival. Not just a rival, but someone else who might have a claim to the throne. Someone who might actually be willing to lead a rebellion against him. Imagine him inviting this rival to come into his house and to sit at the table with his own sons. You might even fear that that would put his sons in danger from this rival. And yet that's what David did. You know what else? That's what God did for you and for me. Invited us into his house, into his table. And that's what grace looks like. That's why we looked at that. We're continuing our series on meeting God's people today. And as we do so, we're going to notice that God's anger is just for a few minutes, but his grace is forever. His love is forever. And as we continue our meeting God's people, we're going to talk about Solomon today. If you've been reading ahead of time, you know more about Solomon than you did last week, and I hope so. And maybe if you've read, I actually considered the idea of just reading through Proverbs this morning. And I thought, well, y'all didn't want to sit here for all of me reading through Proverbs. And I said, well, I could read through Ecclesiastes. That won't take quite as long. Because to me, I see more wisdom from the old man in Ecclesiastes than I do from the man who wrote all the Proverbs, although there's a lot of wisdom in the Proverbs, and I hate to think either. I could have even read James, which would have been a whole lot shorter, and that's Proverbs too. That's Proverbs for Christians, and I think that would have been nice, but it wouldn't have had anything to do with Solomon very much. He's a significant character in biblical history. Solomon is like the epitome of everything. I mean, he's the guy that got everything, and he had power and fame and all kinds of great riches and things like that. He had the corner office. He was the guy. And when we read about him, we see more than 300 times in the Old Testament Solomon is mentioned, and more than a dozen times in the New Testament Solomon is mentioned. That sounds like somebody that's pretty important when you start reading about him and studying about him. In 1 Kings 10, we hear something about Solomon's riches. The weight of the gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traveling merchants, from the income of traders, from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country. In the Old Testament, the word talent was used as a measure of weight, and it was about 75 pounds. So what we're talking about is about $2.2 million, $2.5 million per talent of gold. And he got 666 talents of gold a year. That's like $1 billion a year income. That's more money than Bill Gates. That's more money than Elon Musk. That's more money than some countries. Than many countries. That's a lot of income coming in. He was rich. There's no question about his riches. We go on a couple of verses down and say, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory, and he overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps. The top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat. Two lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the six steps. Nothing like this has ever been made for any other kingdom. You don't know how powerful he was? I've got a throne that rises higher. I've got a throne that's wider. I've got a throne that's broader. I've got a throne that's more impressive. Look at this. Nothing like this has ever been made for any other kingdom. That's how impressive it was. Going down a couple of verses, and Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones. He made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores that are in the lowland. Wow. Riches beyond measure in this kingdom. Power and glory and abundance and all of those things. And not only that, but Solomon was known for his wisdom. All the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules, at a set rate, year by year. Wow. Of all the people in the world, Solomon was a wise guy. He was the wisest of men. By the way, if you're too young to know who those people are, I feel for you. But what can we learn from Solomon? When we look at his life, what do we really learn from the wisdom of the wisest man, maybe ever? One of the things we learn from Solomon's life is that God can bring beauty out of almost any situation. Now, let me rephrase that. Out of every situation, God can still bring beauty. I think when we look back and we look back at the message that Nathan gives David, he says, David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went into her and lay with her, and she bore a son. She called his name Solomon. The Lord loved him and sent a message by Nathan the prophet. So he called his name Jedidiah because of the Lord. Can you imagine Solomon, also known as Jedidiah, but can you imagine what it must have been like to be raised as him? And you say, well, duh, he's the king's son. I mean, that's a pretty good thing. Okay, let me rephrase that. If I told you that this boy was the son of a murderer and an adulteress, what would you think of him then? Because that's who he was. If I told you that he wasn't first in line or next in line for the throne, he was the dark sheep side of the family, would you think the same about him? But that's who he was. And yet God raised him up, and God prophesied that he was going to raise him up in spite of that. You know, God brought beauty and wisdom out of that situation. Ultimate example of that is in Jesus' crucifixion, and we'll see that as we look. But I want to look for a minute at David's family tree. You can't see that picture there very well. But if you look at David's family tree, you see that he's got all of these wives. He's got 10 concubines, and he's got all these children. And Solomon's one of four that he has with Bathsheba. Just one of four that he has with Bathsheba. By the way, if you look at that a little further, David and Bathsheba have four sons there, and out of their four sons, two of them, one is Nathan, one is Solomon, both of them are in the lineage of Jesus. Nathan, Mary's lineage, and Solomon, Joseph's lineage. As we look down through the line of David, there's a very important thing there. That's Solomon's brother, by the way. But there's other brothers there that were ahead of him for the throne, and as we look at that, we see that. I wish my picture was a little clearer. What we see when we look in Acts 2, in the very first picture of wisdom, in the very first picture of Jesus after his crucifixion, that God can still bring beauty out of evil. Peter preaches and he says, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty power or works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves knows. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified by killing at the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it." God took evil and made good out of it. God took ugly and made good out of it. God took sin and made good come as a result of it. As Joseph said to his brothers, "You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good." Solomon came from a union that probably was not what any of us would have recommended for David to be involved in the first place. And God used it for good. And that's something we need to see when we look. Another thing we can see is that there's only one way to approach God, and that's humbly. You know, when Solomon came to God, when he realized the authority that was on his shoulders, when he realized the responsibility that he had, when he realized, no, that's not what people usually realize. You're going to be king. You're going to inherit everything. You're going to be the boss. You're going to be the man. You're going to be the one everybody looks up to. You are going to be rich and famous. And you're going to have everything you ever could possibly dream of in this world. And yet Solomon goes to the Lord in prayer, and he says, "Now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of my father David, although I'm but a little child. I don't know how to go out or come in, and your servant's in the midst of your people whom you've chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude." Let me tell you a secret about this. He's not literally saying that he's a little child. He's not a small child when this happens. He's an adult man. What he's saying is, "I can't handle this by myself. I can't do it, but I don't know how to do this. I'm not ready for this." He's been preparing for it his whole life, but he's not ready for it. Nobody would be ready for that. And in his humility, he comes to God, and he asks God, of all the things to ask for, "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who's able to govern this, your great people?" And it pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, "Because you've asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, now look at what God gives him as a reward. Behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that no one like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I'll give you also what you've not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. And if you'll walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days." Wow. You didn't ask for wealth. You didn't ask for power. You didn't ask for honor. You didn't ask for a long life. You asked for wisdom. And because you asked for wisdom, I'll give you all the rest of it. You know, I think sometimes if we just go to God with an open heart and say, "Hey, you know what, Lord? Give me the strength, the wisdom to follow your way and your will and your word," he'll take care of the rest. He'll take care of the rest. We may not all be rich and famous like Solomon, but you know what? We'll have an abundance of life, because that's why Jesus came, so that we could have that abundant life if we're willing to follow God. And that's the promise that Solomon got. You know, there's an old adage, you know, that works really good. You get more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. This idea of wisdom has so much to do. This idea of humility has so much to do with our relationships. He was humble before God. You know, when we're humble in our family, we have more peace. We're humble in our workplace, we have more peace. We're humble in our relationships with our friends, we have more peace. You know, another way to look at that is what Solomon wrote. "A soft answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger." Part of the wisdom of Solomon as we look at it. Something else we can learn from him, it's possible to possess great wisdom and not put it into practice. You know, I'm reminded of the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. At the very end, when the wizard comes to him and says, "Well, you know, there are many men whose heads are full of facts that don't really have as much wisdom as you and I do. The only difference they've got is they've got a piece of paper." So he gives him a diploma. And immediately the Scarecrow says, "E equals MC squared, because he's so smart now. You know, just being smart doesn't make you wise. And just being wise doesn't mean you'll put it into practice. I know a lot of people who have done things they knew better than to do, but they did it anyway. And some would say, "Well, that's not really wisdom." Well, maybe it's not. But you know, as we look at it, we seem to miss that sometimes. 1 Kings 4 says, "God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore." He was wise and smart. So that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East, all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahal. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. I don't know who those other people are, and you don't either, because their memory doesn't survive. As wise as they were in that day, that they were used as people to model and to modify and to compare Solomon to, they don't exist anymore, and neither does their memory. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs. His songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that's in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. And people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. You know, everyone came to Solomon for wise counsel. Everyone did. Everyone sought Solomon's advice. Everyone knew of his wisdom. Everyone knew of his advice. Everyone knew that Solomon had the right answers to whatever the questions in life that come up. The problem was, Solomon didn't always follow his own advice. He didn't always make the best choices in his own life. You know, we see that, we wonder about that. You know, in 1 Kings chapter 3 in our scripture reading, there's this narrative about these two prostitutes, and they had children, and one of them lay on her child and suffocated them in the night, and the other child, and then they're fighting over whose child is which, and Solomon says, bring me a sword and let me divide him. And we know the story. And when we heard the story this morning, we're like, oh, we know what's going to happen here. And we look at it and we say, you know, his wisdom is great, but no duh, who wouldn't have made that same decision he made? Let me tell you a secret. Until 3,000 years ago, that was not a no duh. The reason it's a no duh question for us today, the reason it's so obvious for us today, is because of the wisdom of Solomon 3,000 years ago when he made a decision that nobody else had ever thought about. We take it for granted because our court systems are based a large part on Solomon and his wisdom from 3,000 years ago, which have passed down through the years into the world we live in today. But we just take it for granted. That's how wise he was. 3,000 years of influence. And yet, he didn't always take his own advice. You know, there's an even better example of wisdom from one of Solomon's descendants. In John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, there's a story of a woman being brought before Jesus. She was caught in adultery, the very act of adultery, it says. And they bring her to Jesus, and they want him to make a judgment. And this descendant of Solomon, this great, 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 however many greats you want to put in there, descendant of Solomon, Jesus himself, sits there and he looks. And rather than making a judgment, Jesus puts the ball back into their own court. And he says, you know what? Let's put the responsibility back on you. You say she's done this. You provide the punishment. And then when they left in their shame, Jesus turned to the woman and he showed her mercy and grace. And he sent her on her way. You know, it's possible that we can have abundance of resources. We can have fame and money and all those kind of things. We can acquire great knowledge and wisdom and yet still fail to apply it. It's one thing to have wisdom in your head. It's another thing to write it down so that you can share it with others. But it's quite another to live it out in your daily life. It's a whole lot easier to say, do what I say, than to say, do what I live. Because the way I live and the way I say, although they ought to be the same, are not always the same for most of us. I had a classmate growing up who could remember every word he'd seen written down. He was amazing. They came in and studied him from the Air Force and places like that, take him out of class and give him all kinds of exams and mess with his head and try to mess him up, and they couldn't. He missed a point in like the third grade. That was it. Missed a point, and that broke his heart, but... And in addition, he had taken a speed reading test, our class. And so he could speed read, and he would take a textbook on the first day of class, and he would read the textbook and turn it back in. He did his homework assignments from memory. Whatever's on page 237, okay, I'll do the questions on page 230. Hated him. No, that's a strong word. But I was sure jealous of that part. If you're in a class with him, it didn't matter if the teacher graded on a curve. Because he made a perfect score, and then he went for extra credit if he could get it. Here's something he could do. He could tell you step by step how to rebuild an engine. Step by step. Every single word straight out of the textbook, how to rebuild an engine. Here's something else. If you took him to the shop, he might not be able to tell the difference between a carburetor and a distributor cap. If it wasn't in the book, he didn't know it. He had all of this knowledge. He had all of this ability in his mind, and he didn't know how to apply it in real life. He's no longer with us. He had some problems, and one time he told me, he said, George, he said, you remember your first crush? I said, yeah. He said, it hurt real bad, right? I said, yeah. He said, but you got over it. I said, yeah. He said, I have it. He said, I can't forget anything. And he didn't live a very happy life. He lived a pretty miserable life. I mean, you might think he was successful. He graduated high school, and he was an MD in 6 years. That's pretty good. Most people go 4 years of college and 3 years of med school and so many years of internship. He went 1 year and got his degree at Washington University, which is a pretty prestigious school. And he went to med school, and then he did his internship, and he was a doctor. Pretty successful, but pretty brokenhearted. And at the end of his life, like Solomon, he would probably say, vanity of vanities. It's all wasted, unless it's right. Because, you know, success can be pretty deceptive. I think sometimes we forget about that. There's a story of Solomon that is really amazing. We just read in chapter 10 of his wealth and of his fame and of his great throne and all the chariots he had and all the value he had and all the people coming to him. But chapter 11 begins rather ominously. It says, "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh." He had married her in chapter 3, and we'll mention that again here later. "Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, 'You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods.'" God didn't say maybe they will. He said surely they will. So it starts off rather ominously there as we look at it. Look at the instructions. Now, we just read about his wealth in chapter 10. We just read about his number of chariots. We just read about his power and prestige in Deuteronomy chapter 17. God had warned the people about not having a king. But then he said, if you get a king, he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order that he might acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. He shall not acquire many wives for himself, let his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. It's almost like Solomon read that passage and said, oh, these are the things I'm supposed to do. Because he took that as a blueprint for his life. And that's what we look at as we look at it. And so then you get this sad result. When Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. His heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. You know, there's a lot of potential danger in relationships. In chapter 3, we see an early marriage alliance. This is before he prayed to God for wisdom. He had married the daughter of Pharaoh, and he had taken her. So he made an alliance with Pharaoh, took Pharaoh's daughter in. He's the young king. He takes Pharaoh's daughter in. The first thing he does is make an alliance with Egypt, because Egypt is the presumed and presumptive power in that part of the world. It would make sense to make a political alliance there, probably. But that's not all. 1,000 wives and concubines, when you add them up, that would lead his heart away from God's. That's what 1 Kings 11 tells us as we look at that. Now, not all of these were romantic relationships. Not all of these were wives in the sense that we would think of a wife today, and it wasn't that way at all. Most likely, many of them were simply political alliances. And many of his wives and concubines probably never even came into his presence. They were simply there as part of a political alliance. That was not uncommon in those days. Others were likely figureheads and servants. I mean, he had beautiful young ladies who could wait on him and wait on those that came to his court, and they're his concubines. And that way he could impress people with his value and worth and wealth and prosperity. You know, the lesson we can learn from this, though, is that the people who are closest to us can have a tremendous amount of influence on us. There are some of you here today. There are some of us here today who are Christians because the person you're married to now had a great, huge influence and impact on your life, and they brought you to Christ. Or because your closest friend shared their faith with you and they brought you to Christ because of the relationship that they had with you that allowed you to see Jesus in them. And there are others that we all know who are not faithful anymore because of the relationships they got involved with that led them away from Christ. And it breaks our heart when we see that. And it breaks our heart when we see what happens when relationships sometimes can lead us away. All the people that are close to us can have a huge, huge, powerful influence on us. That's why it's so imperative that young people marry in the Lord. I think that's why Paul gave that advice. I think it's so important. I absolutely love church camp. I love the area-wide youth devotions that we have. I love Lads to Leaders. I love our Christian universities because they give our children a chance to meet someone of like faith that they can grow with, that they can grow up with, that they can grow old with, and that they can live with throughout life, sharing their faith and building one another up. I love those institutions. I love all of them. I love every opportunity we get for our children to and I don't mean little children, I mean our youth group. I love it when they have the opportunity to be around other Christians, to share their faith with one another and to grow together. Life, and especially the Christian life, it can be difficult enough, even with the support of a like-minded spouse. Those who have lived longer can understand that. Those of you who are very young can say, oh, no, wait a minute, but I'm in love and I'm going to change him. I'm going to change her. No, you're not. Don't think you're going to do something that you're not going to do. It's possible. But God was pretty clear to Solomon. He said, if you marry somebody that's an unbeliever, more than likely they're going to drag you down instead of you bringing them up. And so you need to be careful about that. One of the other things we can learn from Solomon is that wholeheartedness matters. Idolatry will destroy us. You say, well, we don't have idols today. I remember at Rolla we used to talk about icky idols. That was the letter I when we were teaching the little kids in day school. Icky idols. I stands for icky idols. And nobody likes icky idols. And we would never have idols today, would we? No. But we do. We have all kinds of things that we put on a pedestal in our life, and we look at it. In 1 Kings 3, it says, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and made offerings at the high places. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. You know, now, that might be a little bit misleading there when we look at it. I mean, it's a little tricky when you compare it to 2 Chronicles chapter 1 and you read about Solomon there. It says he offered 1,000 offerings on the Lord's altar. And so I've heard people say, well, there's a contradiction there. Maybe he did both. Maybe he offered this 1,000 offerings on a bad altar, and then when he realized what he had done, he offered 1,000 offerings to make up for it to the Lord. I don't know. All I know is that it's interesting that after God grants his request for wisdom, in verse 15 of chapter 3 here, it says that he goes then to Jerusalem to worship God. In chapter 9, God appears to Solomon a second time, and he says, hey, you know what? If you will follow me, if you will live according to my statutes, if you'll live according to my law, if you'll do what I want you to do, if you'll lead the people the way I want you to lead them, I'm going to give you all these blessings, I promise. But if you turn away from me, there's going to be consequences. You see, by chapter 9, Solomon's heart was no longer pure towards God. By chapter 9, he had started to turn away and wander away from following purely after God. And God comes to him a second time. He had completed the temple. And you know what he says? He said, look at the temple of God. That's not what he said. Look at the temple of Solomon that I built for God. He had lost his humility, and he had become something else. And so God promises, I'll be with you as long as you follow my lead. But if you go off on a tangent, there will be consequences in your life. And then we see his ultimate downfall. When we read this part a little bit earlier, look at down at the bottom in verse 6, starting in verse 6. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, did not wholly follow after the Lord as David his father had done. That's where we quit when we read it a while ago. But go on. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on a mountain east of Jerusalem. And he did, so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifices to their gods. He didn't lead them closer to God. They led him further away from God. You see, Solomon's problem was a heart problem. That was his problem. Maybe we can guard our hearts from being divided. And that's my prayer for us today, that we can guard our hearts from being divided and wholly seek God. Ask for wisdom. Ask for knowledge. Ask for guidance. And live according to the Word of God. And He'll take care of all the rest. How do you remember Solomon? Do you remember him as the great, rich, wise king who built the temple and all of the things that he did and brought Jerusalem to great prominence in the world? Who wrote entire books that are recorded in our Bible? Do you remember him for that? Or do you remember him as a king that was carried away by his love of the things of the world and lost his first love along the way, losing his kingdom in the process? He had everything, but he lost everything because he lost God. You know, when I read about Solomon and I read his writings, I find great wisdom in the words of Proverbs. I find great comfort when I read through Proverbs. I love reading that. But when I read Ecclesiastes and I see a wise old king looking back on his life, I see a man who has finally come to a realization that he'd wasted everything and all the time. My challenge for us this week, don't waste your life. Don't waste your life on all the things that look good and sound good on the outside. Follow the wisdom of God and you'll find peace and happiness. Maybe you're not a child of God and it's time to come to God. Maybe you need to put Jesus on in baptism. If you'll confess him before men, if you're willing to repent of your ways and come to him, then you can be baptized into Christ and you can be a new child when you walk out of here brand new, no sins. What a wonderful thing that is. Maybe you're a child of God and you need prayers. Maybe you need to come back. If you need anything that we can help you with, if you'll come to the front while we stand and sing to encourage you.